ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Online, it feels like the answer is always yes. Yes to cookies, yes to tracking, yes to data sharing. I'm Ray Johnston, and in Opt Out, I find out what happens when you finally say no. Opt Out, a special series on Download This Show, ABC Radio National. To hear it, search for Download This Show wherever you get your podcasts or hear it on the ABC Listen app.
Welcome to Late Night Live in summer mode, bringing you the best of 2025. I'm David Marr, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Robert Desay, broadcaster and writer, a man who's lived many lives, published a new memoir this year, Chameleon. It tells a story of an adopted kid growing up in a dull, Yes, dull suburb of Sydney, fleeing Australia to study Russian, living in Moscow, marrying, divorcing, finding love with men, and always questioning the meaning of his life, which, as he insists, is the only life he'll ever have. Robert joins me later. But first, journalism in a world of information chaos. Alan Rusbridger ran The Guardian for a couple of decades, and under him, that old radical brand set up in America and Australia. By the time he retired, Rusbridger bestrode the press world. Now, full disclosure here, he employed me. In 2015, he even flew me over to cover the UK elections. It's an old Guardian tradition of importing a colonial fool for the purpose, and I fulfilled the brief in every possible way. Alan now edits Prospect, an intelligent, elegant monthly in London and online. So I'm here, sitting with this press colossus, who wonderfully still looks like a reporter, slightly puzzled to find himself wherever he is, and patting his pockets every few minutes to check that he has his notebook. Alan, welcome to Late Night Live.
I'm very glad to be here.
Alan, I'm wondering if Donald Trump's attacks on the legacy press aren't in a way encouraging a sort of sign that newspapers and television still matter.
Well, I think it's true that all, what are we going to call him, an autocrat, sociopath, would-be fascist, they all want to capture the media. They want to tame the media because it's considered at best an inconvenience, at worst an enemy. They're quite explicit about it. So to that extent, yes, you could take it as a kind of backhanded compliment that he's gone after them. And he's very specific about which outlets he goes for. So you remember the first 4 years of his presidency, he would go relentlessly after the New York Times, which is a really good newspaper, and call it fake news.
Yep.
And now the targets seem to be Reuters and Associated Press, you know, really, really good, reliable news organizations, as best as they come. And they delight in saying it's all lies, which is extraordinary. I mean, it's just extraordinary, but there you go.
And AP, of course, as well.
Yeah, AP, their sin is that their style book calls the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of Mexico, and they're not going to change their style book because the president says so. And so they are now actually forbidden from White House briefings. And it slightly amazes me that the other correspondents haven't just walked out and said, well, we're not going to cover you till you let them back in. But they haven't.
But I presume that if they did that, and I have the same thought, if they did that, that would be a complete triumph for Trump, because only his pet media would be reporting him.
That is a danger, that he would then pack his White House conferences with, what do we call them, influencers. And with Fox News and right-wing radio stations. But I think in the end, he craves, I mean, he does crave attention, and he wants the respectability of being owned by, being interviewed by these big titles and radio stations. And I think probably in the end, there would be a First Amendment case that would require him to have them back in.
I'm intrigued by his old-fashioned methods, suing newspapers for libel. So hard in America. And yet he's doing it, and he's getting settlements.
He's suing them, and they're caving in, I think, before they need to. And he's also, because it is hard with libel, he's using a bit of law that relates to commercial deception. So he's suing the Des Moines Register in Iowa because they had what turned out to be a rogue poll, if you remember, just before the election, that suggested that Kamala Harris was way ahead. That turned out not to be true. But, I mean, the rogue polls have always existed to actually portray that as a piece of commercial deception, consumer deception, that you were actually deceiving consumers, is a completely novel use of the law. And I assume it's because the First Amendment does, to some extent, protect public figures, people writing about public figures from libel.
It is extraordinary to watch. Do you think that what he is trying to do is to silence all voices, or is it about giving power to the voices that he favours? Do you think his ambitions go as far as silencing all dissent?
I think in a perfect world he would silence all dissent. Yes, I really do. So he wouldn't silence Fox News and the outlets that are to the right of Fox News, or he probably wouldn't silence Joe Rogan, for instance.
No, hard to.
But you can see him in a sort of folie à deux with Elon Musk here, who has a similar obsession. And Musk quite often says on X, his new platform, the legacy media all lie, you are the media. The people are the media. And there is something sort of chilling about that. And when you hear it, it feels like very unhappy precedents in history. And I think Trump is now at the state where he genuinely believes it.
Is one of the great changes that you've seen in your time as a pressman, as a journalist, the use now of the word lie? It was a rare word once, wasn't it? To accuse somebody of telling a lie, I remember, required quite intense consultation with the newspaper's lawyers before you dared
Absolutely.
Call somebody
Absolutely.
A liar.
Yeah.
But now it's just an everyday allegation.
Well, I think Trump has made it easier, certainly in relation to himself. You remember the first time around, the Washington Post had a sort of a tracker of things that he had said that were untrue or were falsehoods or lies. And from memory, they got to 31,000 by the end of 4 years. And during that first Trump imperial presidency, people began to feel bold enough. I think even the New York Times called him out and said these things were lies, i.e. they weren't mistakes, they weren't misspeakings, they weren't even falsehoods, they were deliberate pieces of what we would now call disinformation, not misinformation, disinformation. They were intended to deceive people. And I think in relation to Trump himself, I think it's easier now to see that a lot of this stuff is intended to deceive. But I agree, the word is now much more casually thrown around.
Mm. A few years ago, when the Washington Post was floundering, Jeff Bezos came along, bought it, and was considered a most admirable white knight. But it seems that there's a problem with white knights. What's happening there?
Well, I remember talking to Marty Baron, the great executive editor of the Washington Post, and we were all immensely jealous of him because, you know, we were all struggling financially, and suddenly, as you say, this white knight comes in and seems too good to be true. And Marty, I think, genuinely felt there were no problems with this. What's not to like? This one of the richest men on the planet comes in and says, I admire the Washington Post, I want to save it, and doesn't try to interfere. Two things happened. One was that his patience, I think, was limited, and the Washington Post started to lose money. I mean, they had a lot of staff, good for them, but it's not easy to make money from publishing legacy media now. And I mean, to Bezos, let's be honest, this was like change stuck down the back of a sofa. It was $70 million or something in 1 year. And he brought in somebody to rather brutally constrain the spending, who was himself, Ackerman put it, he has a checkered career in British journalism. But then more alarmingly, there came signs that Bezos himself was going to interfere. And the first sign came when he prevented the Washington Post from endorsing Kamala Harris before the last election. He said that he just decided it was an old-fashioned thing to do for a newspaper to endorse anyone. So he was just prohibiting any kind of endorsement, but you could see that he didn't want to upset Trump. He, rich as he was, he just didn't want to make an enemy of Trump.
Alan, on that point, there have been newspapers long way back who have never endorsed a candidate for an election. They may well argue for a candidate, but not editorialize in support. And that's been considered rather a decent position to take.
I think that's a perfectly respectable position to take, but you don't take it 10 days before an election. Having you know, the Washington Post has got a tradition of endorsing candidates, you know, going back 50 years. So it was a naked piece of obedience. Tim Snyder, the Princeton professor, has got Yale professor has got this phrase: "Don't obey in advance, anticipatory obedience." And you saw that from Bezos there. And then the second thing, which was where the opinion editor resigned, because Bezos had said in future we're only going to run two kinds of opinion pieces. One is pieces that are in favor of individual liberty, and one is pieces that are in favor of free markets.
Quite what do those terms exactly mean?
What do they mean? I mean, let's take Donald Trump and his economic policy at the moment. He's very keen on tariffs. Tariffs are not really consistent with free markets. So you couldn't have a piece that argued that Donald Trump was right, because Jeff Bezos would say, no, I'm running. So he obviously wants to turn the Washington Post into a kind of Wall Street journal, which is extremely conservative. I mean, it's such a misreading of what the Washington Post was, or what I suspect its readers want. It's such a narrowing of the canvas of debate and so anti-journalistic in its instincts that only a billionaire retailer who had no clue what journalism is supposed to be could come up with that idea.
What's he going to do when he finds readers deserting him?
Well, last time round, when he prohibited the paper from endorsing anybody, I think he lost 300,000 subscribers, which is extraordinary. I mean, I was one of them. I just thought, this is not the Washington Post I knew, and I gave up. And then I got these begging emails saying that I could get the entire Washington Post for an entire year for something like £12. And so I went back in, but I'm afraid I'm probably going to have
You were lured in by the deal.
It was an incredible deal.
Such a good deal.
But that's how desperate they were.
Mm.
And I fear I'm going to have to cancel again. I'm sorry, Washington Post.
The Bezos figure is different, isn't he, from former great men of newspapers, like, say, Rupert Murdoch, who will do extraordinary things to protect their empire. But it's a media empire. Bezos has a great newspaper, but he has other businesses to protect, doesn't he? Other ventures.
That is clearly the problem. A couple of months ago, I was in New York, and I had lunch with the former New York Times executive editor, Dean Baquet. And he said, I joke with Arthur Sulzberger, the great editor, the great owner of the New York Times, saying, I'm glad you're relatively poor and you don't have any other businesses. So he's not anywhere near as rich as Bezos, but it's the only thing he owns is the New York Times. And so he can't be, as it were, blackmailed into harnessing the New York Times in the service of his other companies because he's frightened that something might happen to them. I mean, this is just gangster government, and you would think if you were that rich, you wouldn't care if Trump came after you. But it's extraordinary, and it's happened with Facebook as well, and all those tech bros who were on the platform at the inauguration show that they genuinely believe that if they don't bend the knee, then bad things are going to happen.
You wonder what working men and women in America who'd voted for Trump thought as they saw the four richest men in the world clustered around Trump at his inauguration.
I wish I could explain what the American voter thinks of when they're voting for Trump. I suspect they're going to be really angry this time round because none of the things that he's doing seem destined to help them and their pocket. Quite the opposite. I think they're going to find the cost of living rising if all these tariffs go through. So I think he's just going for broke, and hopefully it's the last time. If we have elections again, I mean, you wouldn't put it past him to declare some kind of state of emergency and to cancel elections. But, you know, maybe I'm getting ahead of myself.
Gore, that's a black imagining, Alan. I'm talking to Alan Rusbridger, former editor-in-chief of The Guardian, now editor of Prospect magazine. Alan, Murdoch, has he still got clout in Britain? Do people care what his newspapers have to say about them?
It's such a complicated picture with Murdoch because he's many things. And in Britain, he's The Sun, which used to be hugely influential, sell 4 million copies a day, I think is much less influential. But he's got The Times and he's got The Sunday Times. And although he is 93, I think he still has influence in that company. And I'm afraid, because after the phone hacking debacle and the Leveson inquiry, when people would stop going to Murdoch parties in the way that they used to, they've started again. And I think he does have power and influence. I wish he didn't, but because it's a particular kind of power. It's not just the normal power of the press. It's the way that it was, and all this came out during the Leveson inquiry and in some of the criminal trials. It was the way that power was allied with a form of immunity, really. The police didn't go after him. Other people didn't criticize him. The media were reluctant to shine a light. The regulator never went for him. And so here was this unique figure, really, in public life, who could really do what he wanted. And in a way, it still feels like that.
Politicians, people, some institutions in Australia are still actually scared of Murdoch. Are people afraid of Murdoch in Britain?
I think they are. I mean, if you look what happened over phone hacking, where he's now paid out what is an enormous sum. It's well over £1 billion and counting in costs and damages. So he's buying the silence of what went on in his company.
Yes.
The chief executive, Rebecca Brooks, who was paid over £10 million to go when she was accused criminally of being aware of what was going on. Well, she was cleared of that and was back in the job immediately. These are not things that normal companies do. Normal companies don't try and cover up crimes internally. They don't try and pay off the victims of crimes. They don't, having lost a chief executive whose best defense was, "I'm sorry, I didn't know what was going on inside my company," they don't then rehire them. And so it's a company where Murdoch feels he can give two fingers to the norms, and which can be extremely aggressive in going after people it doesn't like. So this fear of Murdoch is not irrational. It's quite rational.
We've only a minute left. Alan, what would the single best thing the media could do over the next few years? The single best thing they could achieve?
Well, I think as journalists, we should all get behind the idea of public service broadcasting, stop attacking it, and realize that it's actually in a way, the height of what we can do. Secondly, this is an unromantic thing to say, but AI, I think, clearly there are huge dangers associated with AI, but it could be the savior of journalism. What do I mean by that? Well, when you and I started in journalism, every court, council room, planning authority would have a reporter in there, and those days are never going to come back. But if we started with a legal requirement that every meeting involving public money should have an AI device recording it so that it can be accessed and interrogated, and AI will get quite good at reporting those kinds of things, then we're back to the age of having witnesses in public society on our behalf. And combine that with humans and reporters who learn to work with it, I think that could be transformative.
Alan, thank you. I've been talking to Alan Rusbridger, British journalist, former editor-in-chief of The Guardian, now editor of Prospect magazine, on Late Night Live. Coming up, The Chameleon by Robert Desay. Robert Desay lives in Hobart and writes. He used to live in Sydney and talk on Radio National, but 30 years ago he gave up talking about books and started writing his own. And a much-loved ABC broadcaster became a greatly admired writer, and not just here. The books, as they followed every few years, are translated into half a dozen languages. They're wise and mischievous and at times, like him, rather stern. Life is his subject and how lives should be lived. And a new book, Chameleon, he calls it a memoir of art, travel, ideas and love. Full disclosure, I've got a blurb on the cover. I tried to put what I thought into respectable language, but all I could say in the end was, sweet Jesus, this is beautiful. Robert is in our Hobart studio. Robert, welcome to Late Night Live.
Oh, thank you, David. It's lovely to talk to you.
Robert, I'm going to adopt some of the stern mannerisms that you've thrown my way over the years. Robert, this is not your first memoir. Now, what was left to say in Chameleon that you hadn't already said? Are you trying to get it right at last? Or are you finally being truthful?
Well, both those things, I suppose. I was worried that you might ask me this question. You know, I woke up in the middle of the night thinking that you might. The thing is that the world is so awful at the moment that, like Christopher Isherwood, I think, I've decided to retreat from it and go inside myself, because it becomes increasingly difficult to talk about the world outside, I find. It is every morning a challenge. And so I think that this book is a little different. It's the same material in the sense that it's my life used as a basis for talking about life in general. But at the same time, life has taught me something. I have learned something since I started writing. I don't see the world in quite the same way that I used to. So I hope I have some new perspectives, at least, to offer.
How does the world look different?
I think my attitude to death is different. I think that when you're 30, 40, 50, 60, even 70 probably, death looks like an event in the distant future. It looks like something that you're sure you'll handle with a certain grace and perhaps even panache when the time comes. When you get to the age I'm at now, the age I wrote this book at, you don't feel quite so casual about it, I suppose. It's really very close and very present, and so I've had to think through it. My partner, Peter, is quite a militant atheist, always has been, and I suspect always will be, although you never know, do you? He says, unless you accept the fact that you will die and there's nothing else to come, you can't be happy. I would never have said that 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20, 30, 50 years ago. I suspect he's right. I suspect that when you say to yourself, this is it really, it's been special, thank you everybody, there's not going to be any more. You open up a space, a big space, a colourful space, space of many dimensions to be happy in. Strange, but true. And I have felt for some time that those who feel that there is going to be more life, there's going to be another life, perhaps many other lives. For these people, there is often a certain anxiety that overtakes them, whereas for me now, increasingly, there's no anxiety at all.
None.
Well, about Centrelink, obviously about Centrelink,
yes.
Everybody's anxious about that. But no, I don't think so. I think I take Peter's point. I don't know that I would call myself an atheist. I think that's sort of getting a bit bossy, really. But
a bit too definitive.
Yes. Do you agree with that?
No, I think I'm an atheist.
Right. Yeah. Yes, I thought you might think
yes,
that.
I think I'm an atheist. But isn't that appalling, what happens to so many people of deep faith as they're approaching their death? They lose their faith. They suddenly find themselves at the end of their lives without any faith at all. It disappears.
It sort of gets frittered away on things of no importance, even popes, it would seem. But I don't want to mock anybody for not coping. I am trying to find my own way of coping. But really, the main source of fear is how social services will deal with me.
Yes, okay. We'll try to speak in an orderly fashion here, Robert, and leave more of death until the end. Talking about being orderly, you love digression. I have never read a book so digressive. You seem to promise a reader that you are heading in a particular direction, but you go around the world to get there, mate.
Is that good or bad?
Splendid.
Oh, good. I'm pleased you approve. Well, it's just the way I think. This is partly a book that reveals my mind. It's not a public speech. It's not something I might deliver from the stage. It's the way my mind works. And that's how my mind works. I think many people's minds work like that. I pull on a memory and another one follows. And I pull on that and another one comes out of the semi-darkness. And then another one and another one and another one. And there is a little cord connecting them all. But what it is sometimes hard to put your finger on. And this makes life a delight. You can't do that when you're an academic. You have to be logical. You have to make sure that one thing entails another thing. But now, at this point in my life, I just look around and see what comes in the window.
And play.
And play. The most important word in the whole book. Life is not a journey. Life is a playground. A journey implies that you know where you're going. It implies an itinerary. It implies an end point. I don't think like that anymore. I think life is a playground that you go out into and play. And this is the joy of being alive.
You do something very decent in this book, something I don't think that's ever been done before in Australian literature, and that is to pay due respect to the suburb of Lane Cove on Sydney's North Shore.
Nicole Kidman came from Lane Cove. Why are you so down on it?
I'm not down on it. I learned to dance the stomp in a garage in Lane Cove. I played tennis in Lane Cove when I was a child. I'm not down on Lane Cove. It's just an unfamiliar object in high art.
It is, I suppose. I've had a small life, David, really. Quite colourful. I'm not complaining about it. It's been a joy for the most part. But it is small. I am not Nicole Kidman. I'm not Brad Pitt. I'm not Vladimir Putin. I am nobody. And if you
yes.
can embrace your nobodiness, then I think things start to happen. Then things really do start to happen because you start to paper over your nobodiness. You start to clothe your nobodiness with exotic clothes. And I've done that with French. I've done that with travel to India or to Russia or to Bolivia, wherever I might have gone. I think that it's the beginning of life. In fact, no one less than Ben Whishaw said so once. He said, you've really got to admit that you are nothing before you can start to live. I am doing that in this book, I think, David. There is nothing there. There is no substance behind the book. It is papering over nothingness. But I hope in a way that people will want to read about and stay with.
Robert, your life papering over nothingness has had such distinct stages. There was the academic life. How long did the academic life last for?
I suppose for 20-odd years. I have never added them up, but about that.
And after the academic life came the broadcasting life?
It did. That was for 10 years.
And after that came the writing life?
That's right. Sitting about, looking out the window, and occasionally jumping up and writing things down.
Right. And when you began, there was always something very foreign that attracted you. I mean, you became a scholar of all things. You became a scholar of Russian. Was this clear to you that you had this wish to be a foreigner?
Well, I think that it's the advantage of being adopted and not knowing who your father was. My adoptive father, Tom, was quite sure that I was Egyptian. He had theosophical tendencies, and he was quite sure that I was an Egyptian in a previous life. Other people thought other things. It turned out later that my blood relations were basically French. And so I concocted a self. You can do that when you're adopted. You're free. You don't have to grow up like Uncle Harry. You can be whoever you like. And I think that I started very early, and I drew pictures of mosques and cupolas and that sort of thing when I was really quite young. I didn't accept Lane Cove, but I think to do that, you've got to come from Lane Cove.
Yes, but have ambitions to be elsewhere.
No, not ambitions. I hope that's the wrong word. I don't think that I am ambitious in quite that sense. I am fired up by possibilities. Can I say that instead?
Yes, yes indeed.
That's what I think is important. That's why I travel, after all. I've said all sorts of very clever things about why I travel, you know, to expand the mind and all that sort of thing. But in reality, what I'm excited by is the possibility of not being at home, of being somebody else, anybody. That's why I travel. I can't do it while I'm at home. I have to go to India. I have to go to South America. I have to go to wherever it might be. I don't know, East Germany, Greece, somewhere. It's possibilities that I think fire my imagination and turn me into the kind of, well, inventor and indeed liar that I've turned out to be.
Some of the questions I'm going to ask you, I'm asking for myself, really. Is this wish to be away, to be part of foreign cultures, to look to all of these infinite possibilities, is it about not wanting to be yourself? Not admitting your sexuality?
It might have been. I think it might have been subconsciously a desire to explore my sexuality, but I wouldn't have ever admitted that.
No.
But I think that that is possibly a hidden part of why I first left home. I mean, at home, I mean, in the broad sense, home is where you enact a certain kind of sexuality all over the world. It doesn't matter where you are. It's when you leave home that you can experiment with other sexualities. And I think that that's what I've done, particularly ever since I went to Morocco, which is an important, what would you call it? It's an important part of the book, Morocco.
Let's talk about Morocco because, yes, North Africa and Ahmed and that world is clearly hugely powerful in your imagination.
It is. Do you know Morocco? Do you know North Africa?
No, I don't. I haven't been there.
Well, yes. When I first went to Morocco, it was in 1966. So it was quite a long time ago. The lights came on, David. I found out what was really going on behind my screen of primness and respectability. I don't reject that screen. I don't see much wrong with being prim if you want to be prim or being respectable. But in my case, it hid all sorts of shenanigans. When I went to Morocco, I could see people living out what had been on the other side of the screen of the shadow play of my life. And Morocco became very important to me psychologically. From Morocco, I went to Moscow. I got on a plane and went to Moscow, and my life has always seesawed like this, which I'm grateful for. I think it's wonderful the way it has. But Moscow is the opposite, of course, of Morocco. Moscow was the center of an ideology that was enforced upon the entire population. Moscow was very prim. Moscow was very well behaved. Moscow was canonical in every way. Everything that you read, everything that you said was canonical. The opposite of the, what could you say, the sensuality of Morocco, the sunshine of Morocco, the oranges of Morocco, the beauty of Morocco, the sexual extravagance of Morocco, even then in 1966. So the lights came on.
Let me say, this is Late Night Live on Radio National, and my guest is Robert Desay, the great writer, former broadcaster. We're talking about his new book, Chameleon. Robert, asking again for myself, why do gay men marry women?
They marry women because there is no real choice. That's why I got married in 1970. There was no real choice. Yes, you could choose to live differently if you were highly eccentric or highly courageous, but it was simply what human beings do, just as dogs copulate or, I don't know, daisies come up from under the ground. You get married. It's how society works. That's how we thought in those days. It's hard perhaps to throw your mind back, but there was no option. In India, I understand why people marry. You marry in order to establish a household because a man is the head of a household. And unless you marry, you can't be. When I was in Greece, I asked the local policeman in the village that I was in about the man that I'd been writing the book Corfu about, who'd lived in the village that the policeman worked in. And I said to him, what did people think about Kester Berrick? Did they like him, really? Because after all, he was homosexual. And the policeman said they didn't care about his being homosexual. What they cared about was his not having power over a woman.
Good Lord. Good Lord. And that was the idea, that was the ideal of masculinity.
Of course it was. And that's how society worked. And it's only now that we're beginning to see that actually a whole stratum of society works perfectly well without that. But I think if you went out into the suburbs right now, this evening, and asked around, you'd find that perhaps a third of the population would still think that society works best if men marry and take charge of what's called a household. And in India, when I spoke some time ago at a literary festival in Bangalore on a gay panel, it was made perfectly clear to me that as a Westerner, I simply didn't understand, and I should make an effort to understand that what is important is that gay people not try to set up a household. This is what you do in order to have children. What you do with your private parts interests nobody. And I found out that this was more or less true. That's of no importance. What is important is who sets up a household. In Australia, fortunately, we've moved beyond this.
Yes, but your very beautiful account of your marriage in Chameleon, it seems that it's not the sense of being, you know, requiring sex with a man that ends the marriage, but realizing that you're not the kind of man who marries.
Yes, that's right. I think that's true. I'm a man who must be free to find out who he is, and I will get a different answer every time I try. And that will go on year after year, decade after decade, and that's what's happened.
Hence book after book. Gorgeous book after book.
Well, I hope that's true. I mean, your first question does make me a little nervous, but I think that every time the perspective is different. I learn things. The language is different. The sense of self is different. I have come to understand, to answer your very first question, in a way that I didn't until quite recently, that life is a caravanserai. It is a motel for camel drivers. That's what life is. It's not a monastery, which I thought it was originally, where everybody is trying to be right all the time. The last thing you want to be is right. You want to live. And now that I understand and accept the fact that life is this huge caravanserai with lots of camels, lots of camel drivers, lots of different things to eat, lots of different smells, people going in all sorts of directions with different destinations and different beliefs. Now I accept that. I'm a much more peaceful man, I think. And that comes through, I hope, in the book I've just written.
It does. It does. You met the partner, Peter Timms. You've mentioned him already. You met your partner, who refuses to marry, 40-something years ago. Robert, gorgeous in the book. How did you meet and what did you wear to your first meeting with Peter Timms?
Well, I put an advertisement in the paper, you know, in those days we had gay newspapers, and I put an advertisement in the paper after an infatuation that I'd been having had gone hopelessly wrong, was causing me damage. So I put an ad in the paper, and I said that I was theatrical and rather European-looking, and Peter Timms answered the ad, as one did in those days, and it all took time. It took several weeks. I think he paid $2 to answer my ad, or perhaps I paid the $2. Anyway, the whole thing cost us $2, and eventually he rang up and invited me to lunch. And I went to lunch on the third Sunday in January, all those years to go, 40-something, as you so correctly phrase it, wearing shorts and thongs, and this was a mistake. And I suffered from this mistake for the rest of my life. Last year, I bought a pair of shorts and I bought some nice German thongs, very expensive, Birkenstock, I think they are. And I've started wearing shorts and thongs again now because I couldn't care less about any of it.
But I don't really want to intrude, but you describe yourself as, you know, foreign, European, rather exotic, and you turn up dressed like an Australian oik. Didn't Peter sort of wonder whether he had somebody, well, you've described yourself only moments ago as an inveterate liar. How could a man trust you after an introduction like that?
I had good legs.
Ah. But you then hid them until very recently, when we can see them again, presumably at Adelaide Writers' Week.
At Adelaide Writers' Week, I don't know. I'm thinking about that. I think perhaps they should not be on display at Adelaide Writers' Week. I'm 81, but they're still very good.
All right, now I'm going to dive right back to a few details I've always wanted to ask you about. And because we're now on radio, you have to answer. What is it like to take on another name? Does it change you to have another name, or do you feel at home at last?
Well, it's the second, yes, you feel at home at last. It's my birth mother's name, and I feel at home in that name in a way that I did not as Thomas Robert Jones. There's nothing wrong with Thomas or Robert or Jones, and this whole book, Chameleon, the one we're talking about, is my older self talking to Thomas Robert Jones, my younger self. But I feel at home, as Robert to say. I feel that the French side of my nature is paid some respect in that name, and I feel free to be, well, what you called mischievous, I think. at the beginning of this conversation. I don't think Australians are mischievous. I think they think they're larrikins. I don't know what that word really means, and I've looked it up in various dictionaries. I really can't work it out. But mischievous, I understand, and I think to say allows me to be mischievous. I also like Robert because he's a French saint, but he's not a saint in English, really, and I don't want to be a saint. Whereas David is, of course, a saint.
Yes, but not a very colourful saint.
I see.
You know, there aren't splendid paintings of St. David.
No, there aren't.
What does St. Robert do? Was he martyred?
Well, you'd say St. Robert. No, I can't remember what he did. Nothing of any importance. But I can't remember, to be quite honest. As soon as I hear the word saint, my mind starts to go blurry and then clicks off.
Fair enough. We don't want that to happen because we are on Radio National's Late Night Live. I'm talking to Robert Desay, splendid writer, author of a new book, Chameleon. Robert, this is, as you say, a book addressed to your younger self. It's like that old question, what would you say now to your younger self? And that's your book. But it is also conversations with a few people in your life. Are all the people you talk to in the book constructions?
Well, no, but I did see Baby Reindeer on television and I learned a lesson from Baby Reindeer. Of course, I immediately added the sentence, I added a whole page where it says this book is based on real facts or some such sentence.
Because you don't want to be sued.
You don't want to be sued.
As in the Baby Reindeer case.
That's right.
For our listeners, the Baby Reindeer case, explain.
Well, Baby Reindeer starts off with the maker saying, this is the truth, virtually. And it's about a man being stalked by a very easily identifiable woman. And the woman, who, he claims, stalked him, stood up and said, yes, I'll wear that hat. That's me, and I'm going to sue you for a very large sum of money. I don't know if it's still going on or not. I have the feeling she might have won the case. It's a Netflix film, but it is the truth. So I thought, well, I better make it quite clear that my book is not the truth. It's a concoction. It's lies.
Very, very wise.
Yes.
Robert, there's a point in the book which I found very moving where you say that your deepest fear from a young age is of being lonely. And yet you seem to me to be one of the most gregarious of men.
But I visited my own mother and I visited Peter's mother many, many times over a long period in aged care and encountered a loneliness I didn't know existed, really. It was horrifying, the loneliness of Peter's mother, the loneliness of my own mother, once they had been taken out of their domestic environment, horrified me. I'm only cosmically alone. I think socially, no, I am not alone. I'm chatty. I have good friends. I have close friends, not a lot, but I have no family. I have no children, obviously, no brothers and sisters, no father or mother. So it's only friends that I have. And yes, I mean, one is aware as one grows older that one is perhaps less attractive as a friend, that perhaps people will only want to see you once every 6 months instead of once every 6 weeks.
Is that why you've gone to Hobart?
Well, Hobart's actually good for friends because it's like a village, and the village pattern of friendship suits me very nicely. There's an Irish writer called Niall Williams who writes about Irish villages. So does Banville, John Banville, I must say. And there's a particular kind of village friendship pattern that I find comforting. Not too close, not too distant. And that works very well. I have, you know, perhaps three people I feel very close to, but everyone else is a close friend, then they are friends, then they are acquaintances, and of course the colours begin to fade as you move outwards.
Robert, it strikes me that Hobart is a good place to write.
It's a very good place to write. What else are you going to do? Go up Mount Wellington, Kunanie? I don't think so. There's nothing to do in Hobart, nothing at all. I mean, there's more to do here than there is in Kuala Lumpur, for example, where there is literally, absolutely zero. Or Vancouver, nothing to do in Vancouver. You can go and watch a clock that works by steam or something, but there is nothing to do in Vancouver. I went to the Tourist Bureau and they assured me there was nothing that I could do. I would simply have to go and sit on a seat and look. And so I did. In Hobart, there's a little more to do than that, but not much. It's not Melbourne, it's not Sydney, which are marvellous cities in the sense of doing things. Really, it's your inner life that's important here, and so I've developed my inner life. I've tried to make it bigger and richer and deeper and more, what would you say, with more corners to it. And I think it's been good in that sense. There is no parade as there is in Sydney.
There are clues in Chameleon here and there that you've kept diaries during your life. Is there any chance at all that you would publish your diaries?
No, none at all. But they're in the State Library of New South Wales. If you want to fill out a form, you can probably access them.
I can go up there tomorrow.
All of them. Everything's there. My passports are there. Everything is there. I sold them the lot.
Really?
Yes.
Can you do that?
Yes, you can. If you belong to a certain kind of, what shall we say, contingent. Is that an English word? I think it is.
It is English, yes.
Yes.
We've spoken English throughout this interview.
But sometimes I feel I'm making my English up a little bit. But still, yes. I don't think just anyone can approach the library, but they thought my diaries might be useful for people working on my oeuvre, David. If there is anyone working on my oeuvre, then they can go and look up my diaries. I say some sensational things, like Oscar Wilde's heroine, in my diaries. I do. They are mostly written, however, when I am travelling and can look back on my suburban life from a distance. And then certain things stand out and you can see a little bit better how you fit in the world. Because when you travel, you really are nobody. You are of no significance to anybody. If you drop dead on an escalator in a mall in London, they will just push you off at the bottom.
Just a nuisance.
Just a nuisance.
And you are therefore free to see truthfully.
Yes. And to speak the truth to yourself, never mind about power, but to yourself. And so I wrote diaries as I grew older. I mean, the strange thing is that as I grow older, of course, I can't write as well with my hands. So I started writing on computers.
Shocking, shocking.
Yes.
But honestly, Robert, there is no need for people to go to those diaries, at least not yet, because Chameleon, it's a very beautiful book. I'm afraid that I and others will, despite your extraordinary age, be expecting you to keep writing. We will look forward to the next very much. But, Robert, thanks very much for joining us on the show.
Thank you, David. It's been a great pleasure for me.
And that's the show. On our next, we revisit Adelaide Writers' Week 2025, when Late Night Live asked Rachel Kushner, Geraldine Brooks and Julia Baird to address a mighty question, the state of the self in today's world.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.